Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm great.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, we're going to be getting psyched for Megalopolis on this episode by doing the same thing we, the film press, do every time there's a Francis Ford Coppola epic coming down the pike. Obsess over the production of it, right? So from The Godfather to Apocalypse Now to One from the Heart to, I assume, Jack, there's always been some juicy drama surrounding Coppola's latest movie. First up is news that Francis Ford Coppola has launched a lawsuit against Variety and two of its editors for publishing a story earlier this year in which it was suggested that Coppola took liberties with scantily clad extras, pulling them onto his lap and kissing them and announcing that he was doing it all for his own pleasure. The Variety story added some grainy cell phone footage to an earlier Guardian story in which some members of the crew, who mostly seemed annoyed that Coppola was taking lots of time to shoot shots practically rather than doing them quickly via digital means, suggested he was a dinosaur from another time and he behaved inappropriately in this, the post-Me Too era. Except, one of the women featured in the video, Raina Menz, she came forward, said the allegations were insane, that, quote, he did nothing to make me, or for that matter, anyone on set feel uncomfortable. I feel disgusted. I was blindsided by it because it was a closed set. That someone had video of it. That is just ridiculous and super unprofessional. It's gross because he only ever spoke about how wonderful his wife is. His wife was on set with us most days. It feels gross seeing that video and they were there trying to convey a message. Just gross, end quote. There's a secondary angle here, which is kind of interesting, namely that the quote above came in a Deadline story, which was rebutting a Variety of story, both of which are owned by the same media conglomerate. Indeed, Mike Fleming of Deadline kicked off his piece with the following line, quote, our sister publication, Variety, last Friday published for clicks what it called an exclusive video of Francis Ford Coppola kissing Megalopolis extras, end quote. That's just a funny media aside here. It doesn't really bear any weight on the story itself. I'd be shocked if Coppola wins this case. It's nearly impossible for public figures to win a libel suit in America, thanks to the First Amendment. Thank for that First Amendment. It's good to see. But it's hard. I feel for the guy. I feel for Francis Ford Coppola. I feel for him. The story was clearly intended to damage the film with very online sorts. They're very mad about it. There were many, many angry tweets and stories and, you know, oh, he's a dinosaur. He's past his prime. He shouldn't be doing this anymore. The story was clearly intended. Well, I don't know if it was intended to hurt the film, but that was certainly a secondary consequence here. You know, he put his own money into this picture. He needs a miracle to make it back. He doesn't need folks in the media out there destroying it in a callous sort of way. So there's one angle to the Megalopolis back and forth. Here's another interesting little Megalopolis note. Last weekend, it was revealed that Coppola had been working with Amazon to develop a voice recognition software to allow audiences to interact with star Adam Driver on screen in a key scene in which he's taking questions as part of a press conference. Apparently, this was part of the showings at Cannes and other festivals. They have somebody in the audience, you know, asking questions of Adam Driver, which is kind of interesting. And this whole idea of throwing this open to the general public is both the greatest and the most terrible idea I've ever heard in my life. It's the sort of thing that sounds interesting. It's a sort of technological leap forward that you might need to help keep theaters viable, but would have inevitably led to pandemonium as people, you know, shouted over one another in some screenings while the would-be stand-up comedians of the world would get up there to act out their humorous impulses. I got to be honest, it's the worst idea I've ever heard in my life, the more I'm thinking about it. Alyssa, as we head into Megalopolis Eve here, the movie debuts September 27th. We were just discussing where on the schedule we're going to be reviewing it. Do you think any publicity is good publicity? Or is this movie DOA regardless? And this is just a chance to recoup kind of his advertising budget on the film? What do you make of this this lawsuit just on the merits from what we understand?
I feel like it's very hard for me to address the prospects of Megalopolis in a coherent way, considering how weird it sounds. And I For me, that's a compliment. I'm extremely excited to see this. I hope it is incredibly strange. Peter, you really should come back to DC so we can see it together, because I am not going to be able to convince my husband to see this with me, I don't think.
I'm coming back, just not sure I'm coming back that day.
Maybe you should make an exception. So I am looking forward to the weirdness of Megalopolis, but I have no idea how the world of moviegoers at large is going to respond to this movie, which secondarily makes it very hard for me to render any judgments about the merits of a strategy intended to damage the movie. I'm not even sure. I feel like I have a very hard time evaluating any part of this story, right? I mean, it's possible that Francis Ford Coppola interacted with some person or people on the set of a movie in a way that did not make them feel good. It's possible that that person or persons subsequently decided that they wanted to damage the movie and thought this would do it. I'm not sure how to parse the wisdom or rationality of such a strategy. Because the combination of this sort of incredibly weird sounding movie and incredibly online culture, just there is not a logic at work here that I feel like I can parse in a way that's particularly intelligible, which I realize is a total non-answer, but it is definitely a situation where, you know, I don't feel like we have incredibly strong evidence about what happened, which makes it hard to render any sort of moral judgment on this. And this is so not a commercial movie. It's so not a movie that fits into sort of our pre-existing scripts about who's going to be going to see it and what would matter to people's decision-making processes, that I feel like it's very hard for me to analyze.
Yeah, no, one of the things about this movie is that it does feel like it is very much aimed at a niche audience, which is to say, like, self-described cinephiles, which,
yeah, you know, don't have a movie podcast, what's even the point of watching this movie?
If you don't have a Letterboxd account, if you aren't on Letterboxd, are you excited for this? It's hard to say.
Letterboxd. I'm excited.
Why aren't you on Letterboxd?
Because I got a movies podcast.
And they're not mutually exclusive. You can do both. So anyway, what's interesting about this story to me is it really is like a continuation of the long-running Francis Ford Coppola, like, it's a disaster, everything's going terrible, you know, blah, blah, blah. And like, a lot of the time it works out fine in the end, which is, of course, I think what we're all hoping for here.
Man, if anybody wants to see the ultimate Francis Ford Coppola disaster on set movie, watch Heart of Darkness, the documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now. It's totally insane. It's even more insane that that movie exists at all, much less that it's one of the best movies ever, as far as I'm concerned. Like, it's just the movie took like a year to make. They fired Harvey Keitel, you know, after like a week or two, switched out stars, like the whole thing. He didn't have an ending. He just didn't, like, Coppola is like wandering around the jungle with a bunch of cameras and helicopters. And like, how's this movie going to end? I don't know. We'll find out. It took him forever. And of course, it turned out to be Apocalypse Now. And it's, the movie is unimpeachable. We're still watching it. It's still being played in theaters. I don't know that that's going to happen here with Megalopolis, but he does seem to run his sets in a way that is sort of unconventional or chaotic, is instinctive. It's not, he doesn't go in knowing exactly what he's going to do and just sort of have it all planned out. And I think for some people, that's probably pretty uncomfortable. It makes for off-screen on-set drama that the film press loves. And it's especially relevant because sometimes the guy produces masterpieces. And that's actually in some ways, that's the bottom line here. That's the reason we're talking about this. Because if Francis Ford Coppola was somebody who consistently produced junk, we wouldn't care that much. We just wouldn't be bothered with this. If somehow or another he had produced junk movies that, oh, they were modestly successful, maybe he wouldn't be making movies anymore, right? Because if there was this much drama. But like, this is the guy who made the first two Godfather films, The Conversation, and Apocalypse Now in a decade. Like, you get a free pass to make movies for the rest of your life, if that's what you, not to do anything you want, but to make movies and to be kind of chaotic for the rest of your life if you made those four movies in a row. So,
all right, we don't know enough about this lawsuit.
Yeah,
we that's what it comes out to.
We need more information.
We also need to see the movie. I don't think we need to see the movie to judge the potential misdeeds exist independent of the film.
For sure.
Right? We say you can't, artistic brilliance cannot be allowed to excuse misbehavior. That's what we all say now. Whether or not we believe it. I would say, all right, so let's set that all aside. And instead, let's focus on the idea of people shouting questions to Adam Driver at the screen. This is the worst idea I've ever heard in my life. I'm sorry. Like, I was, like, trying to give it the benefit of the doubt. And then as I was explaining it out loud, I was like, I've seen movies with real audiences. They're the worst. Real audiences are terrible. They can't be bothered to get off their phone for 20 seconds to watch the goddamn movie in the first place. You're going to give them carte blanche to ask questions at the screen and have some sort of AI prompt, sending the film to the correct answer. And how would that even work? What's the technology like there?
Well, clearly it wouldn't work. The technology doesn't fully exist yet, but we're certainly in the realm of having a technology like that exist. I think, I'm not sure how I feel about maybe having something like that for every screening, but certainly like, oh, this is an AI prompt screening, right? And it's labeled, you know what you're getting into. I think I would be kind of amused by this. This whole thing, though, reminds me, I'm going to tell a slightly off color, but mostly juvenile story here that, stop me if I've told this on this podcast before. So this story I'm also going to tell you might be apocryphal. I have never seen any evidence that it is definitely true, but I heard it and I think it illustrates so much about the world we live in that I'm going to tell it anyway, even if it turns out to be totally fake. But you throw this back at me and be like, Peter, that's not true. Okay, I'm just telling you up front, might not be true. So I heard about a video game in the early days of online play, of online competitive play, and this was an online shooter, right? It's going to appeal mostly to like teenage young boys. And they gave the players the option to upload their own avatars. And again, this was 20 something years ago, right? And so instead of just playing as the character that you were like, you know, assigned as, you could upload your own avatar, or maybe it was like you could upload it as like your flag or whatever the other person would see when you killed them. Doesn't matter. Point is, you could upload an image, an avatar, a thing that would define your character. And as soon as they turned this option on, it was like 18 minutes into the first game when every single player was a penis.
Yeah,
every single one of them, right? And so this is what gave us the story from
Mythic Quest?
I don't know. I don't watch Mythic Quest. I heard this story from somebody a long time ago. And I think about it all because it gave rise to the very funny stat for like time to penis, right? And it's why all these game companies don't like allow their mostly teenage boy population to have like a total control over all this stuff, because you just get TTP, right? It's just like, oh, well, that's what's... And like, there would be some version of that in so many movie theaters if you got to scream at Adam Driver, and it wouldn't necessarily be like people taking it like images of, but there would be an obscenity or a stupidity that the crowd would quickly home in on and land on, right? In the same way, it would be Bodie McBoatface, right? Like, give the crowd the option to do something really amusing and obnoxious, and they will do it. And I kind of wouldn't mind seeing that in a theater.
Alyssa, what obnoxious thing would you ask Adam Driver at the AI interactive Adam Megalopolis Driver screening?
I would ask him if Hannah Horvath and his character from Girls eventually get back together.
Okay. Boring.
Right. Sorry, I'm not a teenage boy.
Terrible. Terrible.
I mean, it is interesting hearing about this after I spent a lot of time last year sort of reporting on this attempt to create like a new wave of AI toys. And actually, like, PBS is working on a version of this kind of conversational AI that at some point they hope to roll out in this newest show, Lila in the Loop, that is in part about computer programming. So I think this stuff is... a lot of people are at least experimenting with it. And it is interesting that, you know, Coppola, who, you know, we're just talking about how he was maybe sort of getting slammed for doing practical effects, is trying to think about this kind of interaction. Because I think it would be really interesting long term as movies try to, you know, find ways to be relevant, interesting in-person events, if you started to see some more sort of choose your own adventure kind of movies where there are different outcomes based on audience participation. You know, if you look at the success of stuff like Sleep No More, the big sort of long-running New York interactive theater experience, it does not surprise me at all that someone is thinking at least a little bit about how to integrate AI in movies and maybe create a slightly different result. So I am maybe a little bit less skeptical of this than you guys. I mean, look, I think movie theater audiences, like, who knows how people are going to behave. That would obviously be incredibly variable. But as Peter suggested, I do think that some kind of sort of flagged in advance as interactive option might be really interesting for some of these things. You know, people like alternate endings.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. They've tried this with DVD and it works fine, but it's kind of dull. It's not, you know.
It's also just like, it's a lot of work. You know, talking to people who are trying to develop sort of kids' toys where, you know, it's not, because they don't want it to be generative AI, right? It's not, you know, what these AIs are doing and what it sounds like Coppola's, you know, algorithm would have done is pick from a bunch of sort of pre-selected or pre-recorded, right, pre-taped answers to a huge array of questions. And, you know, trying to come up with like all of the possible responses to all of the possible reasonable questions is really, really hard. So in some ways, I mean, I think it's a much harder and sort of more effort intensive experience than just like plugging ChatGPT into your movie.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. I don't really have a con or non exit question here because like I said, we don't have enough information. So I'll just ask, on a scale of 1 to 10, how excited are you for Megalopolis, Alyssa?
Like 8. I think even if it's really weird, it's going to be a good time. And it's been kind of a blah year for movies for me. I'm looking for something that's going to make me feel anything at all, and I suspect Megalopolis will do that.
Peter?
Like a 9.6. Just
10.
Very curious.
The answer's 10.
Very
it's
curious.
10, all the way to 10. You turn 11. You go to 11 on this one. These dials go to 11. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode on thrillers with a conscience. Speaking of which, on to the main event. Rebel Ridge. Written and directed by Jeremy Saulnier, Rebel Ridge's elevator pitch is something like, it's Rambo, but about civil asset forfeiture rather than the mistreatment of Vietnam War vets. What is civil asset forfeiture, you may be asking? Well, apparently that was a question on lots of people's minds, given that the search query shot up Google Trends after the film's debut on Netflix on September 8th. There's going to be some spoilers coming up, including a discussion of what civil asset forfeiture is. So if you want to Google it for yourself, if you want to watch the movie and find out on your own, stop listening. Go watch the movie and come back. We'll be waiting for you. All right. So as depicted in Rebel Ridge, civil asset forfeiture works a little something like this. The cops stop you or search you, and if they find some cash or goods they believe to be used in the commission of a crime, they seize the goods or the cash. If you can't prove it wasn't being used for a crime, you can maybe get it back eventually some months later. When Terry Richmond's $36,000 is seized by some local cops who threaten to arrest him for felony evasion for failing to pull over his bicycle immediately, and then they find the cash during a search, he doesn't have a few months. He has a few days. He needs $10,000 to bail his cousin out, who has turned state's evidence some years prior in order to save him from getting killed in the state penitentiary where he's about to be sent by the corrupt local cop. Terry, who is played by Aaron Pierre, tries to make a deal with that corrupt local cop, who's played by Don Johnson, and that effort fails, as does Terry's effort to acquire another $10,000 from his former employer, the owner of a Chinese restaurant. Because Terry said he got some of the $36,000 from cashing out his share of the restaurants. The cops then raided the restaurant and seized its funds, putting Terry in an even tighter spot. As all of this is going on, Terry is working with Summer McBride, who's played by Anna Sophia Robb, to find out why so many people are being held on misdemeanor charges for so long in this little town. Turns out they're being held just long enough to let the forfeiture dispute time frame expire. And Terry snaps in the calmest way possible, using his skills as a martial arts instructor to disarm the local cops and try to get his money back. We go from there. There's action, blah, blah, blah. A couple of things here, right? Rebel Ridge, it's not quite a slow burn, right? But it's not first blood either. The action tends to happen quickly and with minimal bloodshed. And indeed, I almost can't fault audiences for wanting a little more cathartic violence, because this movie is just an accumulation of infuriating incidents, like one on top of each other, just suffocating in their unfairness. You wouldn't mind seeing Terry snap a few necks in the midst of this, is all I'm saying. A little bit more violence, frankly, would have been very cathartic. Or honestly, Sonia could have gone all the way the other way with it, with the ending, right? He could have, rather than having Terry and Summer expose the evils of police chief Sandy Byrne, the frustration could have ended with the two of them dying, their cause unresolved, the small town continuing to live off of the illicitly obtained forfeitures. The ending as it exists in this film is a little pat. It's a little, you know, hey, good guys win. And that's fine. That's fine. You got to give people, I guess, a little hope here. But it was just a little pat. That's my biggest knock on it, honestly. I think it's a great acted movie. Interesting little fact here. Aaron Pierre stepped into the film after John Boyega walked away from shooting. They had begun shooting the film. It was kind of in the weird COVID time when there were still all sorts of, restrictions and stuff. John Boyega walked away. Aaron Pierre stepped in. And this is a star-making turn for Pierre. I mean, just like, I've liked him before in some things. He was in Old, the M. Night Shyamalan movie about the beach that makes you old. He was in that movie. I liked him in that. And he is just great here. Absolute star stuff. Don Johnson, great. The acting's all very good. And I have to salute Saulnier for making the most effective piece of political filmmaking in the last 5 or 10 years, the most effective I've seen in a long time, right? This isn't a didactic message movie, though it is a movie with a message. It is a thriller with a conscience. It's one that shines a light on a very specific, weird policy niche that, like, everybody in our sphere knows about and, like, kind of hates. But, I would say the general public at large is not that familiar with civil asset forfeiture, and he wraps it all into a very entertaining drama. The movie will do more to raise awareness about the abuses of civil asset forfeiture than a dozen documentaries or a million feature stories would. It helps that it's on Netflix, where it racked up more than 30 million views in its first 3 days. Peter, before we get to your take, the world has to know. You have to tell the truth now. Put away your lies and tell the truth. Was Rebel Ridge a co-production of Reason and the Institute for Justice alongside Netflix? Did you guys make this movie with Netflix? I have to know.
Sadly, we were not involved. I guess I can't speak for IJ, so I only work for a Reason. To my knowledge, IJ, the Institute for Justice, which does a huge amount of litigation around civil asset forfeiture issues, to my knowledge, they were not directly involved. However, it's possible that something that they could have been involved in the background in a way I don't know. I can say that the Reason Foundation, Reason Magazine, my employers were not directly involved, but we are very excited about this movie because this movie plays out like an awful lot of the asset forfeiture stories that we have published, some of which I have been lucky enough to edit over the years. Billy Binion and CJ Ciaramella, two staff writers with Reason Magazine, have both covered this extensively. Many of the just sort of stories, and every single story is enraging because essentially what asset forfeiture is legalized theft. You don't have to have done anything wrong. You don't even have to have been charged with a crime. In many, many of these cases, you have people who have had cash or their vehicles, things that are actually quite important for them, just getting, like, operating their daily lives and having and making their lives run on time. Things taken from them, seized. And it takes them, if they can get it back, it can take months and months and months and hours and hours and hours, and just a huge, huge lift on their part. And in many cases, these are not people who are well off. These are not people who have a lot of resources, who, you know, have a lawyer on retainer. So to see that dramatized in this way is really pretty incredible. I loved this movie. And, you know, you said it was an incredibly effective political film, Sonny, and I very much agree with that. But it's not just effective because it kind of smartly walks you through the way that asset forfeiture works and all of the enraging things that are about that there are about it. And there's so many great little details in this movie, in particular, like the way that it turns out the asset forfeiture is there to fund a bunch of the municipal government shortfall, and also that the cops are using it to buy a whole bunch of fancy weaponry, including some stuff that they have to call less lethal rather than non-lethal, but kind of crowd control stuff, which of course comes back and is used really effectively in some of the final action sequences. And like that sort of thing, maybe not every specific detail, but that is directionally correct in terms of understanding how asset forfeiture works. They get to keep the money. That's one of the reasons they like this process, is because the police officers get to keep the money and use it to fund discretionary budget items. They often will buy sort of highly militarized weapons, trucks, you know, sort of tactical toys with this money. And so seeing that on screen is surprising and gratifying. But what I want to say, the point I was trying to make here is it's not just that it's a good political movie. It's just a really well done thriller. This is a taut, tight story that is satisfying, that sort of brings you in and makes you root for the hero and makes you really sort of care for these people and for their plight and for the unjust thing that was done to them. It's not about speechifying and moralizing. It's about making you care about a person and their and the thing that they are going through. And that's how you tell a story and get people to care. Like, that's what political movies should be. And I think about this in contrast with something like the movie The Laundromat, the Steven Soderbergh movie that we all watched about, campaign finance reform and all the sort of funny money shenanigans, that literally ends with Meryl Streep taking off her costume and speaking directly to the camera and just like delivering a monologue. And it's like the comparison between the two, it's like that, if anything, that speaking to the camera moment, that sort of righteous, like, oh, like, we're going to just tell you how it is. Like, it made me care even less. It turned me off. Whereas a story like this, even, yes, of course, I am already quite sympathetic to the cause, but seeing it play out just as a narrative and just as a story where they get the details, again, not if necessarily absolutely perfectly right, but like pretty close, especially as to how the forfeiture part of it works. It's really effective both as making a good movie, but like you get a good political movie by making a good movie, I guess is the point that I'm trying to make. And so many political movies seem to think that the way to make a good movie is just to sort of build an op-ed in feature form. And this movie's like, nah, we're not doing that. We're just going to make a good movie.
It really is. But it is like a good op-ed, weirdly. Like a good op-ed tells a story, right? A good op-ed, Alyssa is better, you know, versed in this sort of stuff than I am, being a editorial page, an op-ed page editor for a long time. But like you want to hook people's attention by giving them a specific thing to focus in on before pulling back to the general and then coming back to the specific. And this does a very good job at that.
I do want to bring Alyssa in here, but just on the op-ed distinction here, I think that it works like a good feature story, like a reported, you know, long reported story. And that's what we try to do with a lot of the stuff that we publish at Reason Magazine, is we're trying to tell specific, true human stories that illustrate what's actually happening. This movie is, of course, not true in the sense of telling a true story, but it is quite specific, quite focused, and in that respect works like a lot of the reported features that we publish.
All right, Alyssa, what did you make of Rebel Ridge?
I find y'all's reactions to this movie really interesting, in part because it makes me see, I think, how both of you must see liberals getting really excited about a movie that's about their pet issues. I did not find this movie particularly engaging. I think it is too long. I actually think it does a fairly poor job of character development. Like, we get no information about sort of Terry's ties to this area, why he's showing up, like why he's biking into town, right? Like, why is he riding into town on like a multi-$1,000, like, you know, like bike instead of just like renting a car like a normal human being? He is basically a collection of abilities and convictions without sort of quirks or personality. And I think Pierre is fine in the role, but he really is not given very much to work with. You know, they do a little bit better of a job developing Anna Sophia Robb's character. Like, she has an actual backstory, sort of ties to the place, restrictions on her actions, etc. But I don't think it's a particularly strong – I don't think, you know, as a set of sort of characters or place, it's particularly strongly developed. And I actually did find it a little more sort of op-ed-y and obvious than I think either of you did. And I guess I also found it kind of funny that both of you sort of responded so strongly to the idea that this is sort of the rare movie that's about kind of like granular policy, because it's, I mean, just, you know, it's not. I don't know. Maybe I'm being too hard on both this movie and you guys, but it was just sort of an interesting moment to be on kind of the outside of a reaction that I think both of you sometimes have to me and to liberals in general.
Well, sometimes it's nice to be pandered to, Alyssa. We don't always get the, you know, the Hollywood back scratching treatment like you libs out there.
Yeah. Like, look, I love you both dearly, but I do think both of you are maybe slightly overrating this movie because it's rare for y'all to feel ideologically affirmed by a movie like this. And to be clear, I too am ideologically affirmed in that I think that civil asset forfeiture is sort of obviously a cancer in American police departments. But it's not as unusual for me to feel affirmed by a movie like this. And yeah, look, I think the structure of this is fairly good, right? It's like, you know, you have a guy come into town, like the policy issues sort of expand, you see that come together. But I don't actually think that that is sort of, the movie may be unusual in its sort of ideological libertarian valence, but it's not really unusual in using these sort of events or policies as kind of frameworks for this sort of storytelling. Like, I don't know if either of you have seen Barry Levinson's Tin Men, which if you haven't, great movie. But it is in part about the pressures on a pair of aluminum siding salesmen played by Danny DeVito and Richard Dreyfuss. And like their profession is under threat because Maryland is cracking down on like shoddy home improvement contractors, right? And it's like a classic Barry Levinson movie driven by sort of a municipal regulation question. You know, JC, more recently, like JC Chandor's A Most Violent Year is, you know, sort of, again, driven by like politically motivated investigations into a specific class of business. And again, like I think this movie is plotted fine. I think the performances are fine. I was not as moved by Aaron Pierre's either of you. Although I guess we'll see how he is voicing Mufasa. But I was very underwhelmed by this, and was sort of, it was interesting to me how both of you responded to it. And I'm not trying to be a jerk about that. It's just like,
I think that's totally fair. The one thing I will say, I do think it is a little bit flabby at 2 hours and 10 minutes or so. I mean, yeah. There's a lot of Netflix credits at the end, but the original First Blood, I think, is like 93 minutes or something like that. And this is a movie that should have been closer to 93 minutes than 2 hours and 10 minutes, frankly. And I do think part of this is the weakest part of it is the investigation into the township. There's like a whole subplot with James Cromwell as a judge that probably could have been lost, I think. And that stays in for, I think as an attempt to like try and make it make sense why the town is like stealing all of this money and why nobody wants to stop it, which again, we can discuss as like a political thing, but it is a storytelling weakness. It's soft in the middle.
Yeah.
In a way that a movie like this shouldn't be.
And it ends up sort of, again, kind of fleshing out, you know, Summer's character. But there, again, because there isn't sort of equivalent development of Terry as like a person, as opposed to like someone who can give himself a really good shave while the straight ravers are in the woods. Like,
Yeah, see, I mean, again, this didn't actually bother me that much because he, again, if the idea here is like civil asset forfeiture Rambo, it's not like John Rambo, you know, has a ton of backstory in that film.
I think similarly with something like Die Hard, you look at John McClane's character, and it's not that his character isn't well developed, actually, but you sort of don't. You just kind of learn about him through the choices he makes over the course of the film. You learn a little bit about his relationship to Holly Gennaro at the beginning, but it's mostly about like here's how he is in the moment.
But right? There's this a lot of texture. There's a lot of texture in those moments, right? I mean, there is sort of, you know, there is a class dynamic with Hans Gruber. There is, you know, the tension over his wife going back to using her maiden name. Like there is a lot more texture in the moments in that script than there is in anything here.
The Aaron Pierre character passed my test for what I think is a good character, which is I feel like I in fact can imagine him in scenes that aren't in this movie, what he's like. There's a lot we don't know about him. That's true. But he's real enough in the way that he responds to things. He has a consistent and revealing demeanor that it seems like, oh, you can actually just sort of imagine this guy doing non-movie things. And it doesn't seem like, wait, he only exists as this collection of things that you need to get through these 40 scenes or whatever it is in your film. And so a lot of that is Pierre, is that it's not necessarily in the script. It's that he is building that into his physicality, into the way his face responds to this things. He's got this incredible kind of always watchful face where you just see him. I mean, some of this is explicit, but even when it's not, you just see him kind of looking all around him and mapping everything in his world and then planning and making, you know, and learning, like thinking about what to do with his physical surroundings. But then you also see him over time, especially in the first 40 minutes of the movie or so, first hour, learning how to handle other people. And so that's the people in the police station, and in particular, Don Johnson's police chief character, where his approach to the Don Johnson character changes quite a bit over that first hour. And that is part of the learning process that you are seeing with him, is that he's somebody who you just see him problem solving in a particular way all throughout the movie. And that goes that goes a long way towards establishing his character and who he is and making him believable enough. And then Pierre just plays him in such a an engagingly natural way that I don't know. I did not see him as a flat or shallow character, despite. Yeah, I think it's fair to say there's not a ton of detail, but you don't always need a ton of detail. Sometimes characters just reveal themselves by the way they behave.
And I'll say his lack of, I've seen somebody else mentioned a lack of backstory to the character. And I think more movies should have less backstory for their characters. Frankly,
where did Sonny Bunch come from?
I don't need to know why he decided to become a McMaps, you know, Marine Corps martial arts program instructor. I don't need a 5-minute monologue where he's talking about the kid who got beat up in front of him and he couldn't protect him and that's why he decided, you know, but like I don't need that. Again, this is why the Rambo comparison is a good one in this sense, in that, you know, I think that movie reveals the character of Rambo through Sylvester Stallone's performance. And here again, I think Pierre does a very, very good job of revealing the character through how he interacts with everybody else in the world. Again, I like absolutely do not disagree with you, Alyssa, that this movie is a little bit flabby in the middle. And frankly, I could have used getting rid of, I could have used less backstory about Anna Sophia Robb. I don't care about her being a junkie who needs to get her kids back. Like none of that is that interesting to me, but it is, but again, it is, it like works as another layer of like, look at the corruption of small town police. This is bad. We should not, you know,
also the cost of the drug war and the ways in which it puts people under the thumbs of authorities, people who, it empowers government authorities, police officers, et cetera, to abuse resources and make other people's lives miserable. And that's so the civil asset forfeiture is not just a kind of practice that exists without any context. It is a practice that grew out of the drug war. You see this explained in the movie, right? It was sort of there. Oh, we're going to fight cartels with this. And, you know, when I watched the movie the second time, it became even clearer that this is a civil asset forfeiture film. Yes, very much first and foremost, but it is also really about the ways in which the drug war empowers bad actors and makes corruption possible all throughout systems of government.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Rebel Ridge? Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Peter?
I loved it. I would not be surprised if this is in my top 10 movies of the year.
I assume that means thumbs up. Thumbs up for me. Good movie. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.